Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism webinar. I'm David Feldman, the director of the Institute, and I'm really hugely pleased to be able to introduce our speaker today, Britt Tevis. Britt has held fellowships at Yale and at the University of Pennsylvania and is currently at Indiana University. And Britt is a historian whose research lies at the intersection of legal history and American Jewish history. She has a law degree as well as a PhD in history. And I think this really contributes to the originality and significance of her work. So I'm really much looking forward to her talk this afternoon on anti-Semitism in American history, reflections and ways forward. Britt, it's all yours.
Thank you. And thank you to Professor Feldman for the invitation and Tanisha for helping with all the logistics. I'm really quite thrilled to be here. As the title of my talk today indicates, I am going to be discussing the historiography of anti-Semitism in the United States. And I am especially pleased to be interacting with and speaking with a primarily academic audience because I really love historiography, but oftentimes not everyone does. So having the opportunity to speak with other academics allows me to really get into the nitty gritty of historiography, which is something I really love. The talk that I'm giving today is based on a recent article that I published in American Jewish History, this journal. And so the sources and references for those of you who are interested in reading more are in that article. With that said, first, I'm going to begin by offering a diagnosis of the current state of the field of the historical study of anti-Semitism in the United States. And to be perfectly blunt, it is, of course, I'm going to say, woefully underdeveloped. Relatively little is written on the subject. It's under-theorized. And what is written on the subject has been rather repetitive and taken a certain format and made largely the same claims. And that is because until relatively recently, and arguably still, most scholars, and particularly American Jewish historians, have concluded that anti-Semitism in the United States has been and is a fleeting phenomenon, and relatively speaking, insignificant. And in particular, relatively speaking, insignificant relative to racism, and especially anti-Black racism. It's a pre-modern relic in this reading, rather than a manifestation of modernity, and something that will inevitably soon die out. According to this argument, where we have seen anti-Semitism, it has been unrelated to law, unrelated to politics, and instead has predominantly operated in private spheres and in social relations between Jews and non-Jews. Where work does discuss anti-Jewish bigotry, discrimination, violence, anti-Semitism, again, is episodic, temporary, and isolated. You see these words pop up over and over again. Continuities are almost entirely ignored and denied. And today I want to talk about how this came to pass. Why is this? Why is this the framework with which scholars continue to use to think about anti-Semitism in the United States? Well, to understand that, we need to go back to the origins of this field of study and understand the tremendous intellectual influence of two mid-century immigration historians, John Higham and Oscar Hanlon, whose ideas about anti-Semitism first appeared in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And their ideas, shockingly to me at least, continue to largely shape the field all this time later. So the first thing to know about the historiography of the field is that academic historians first began to think about anti-Semitism in the United States in the late 1940s and the early 1950s. And they did this in the context of very heated debates about American populism, the late 19th century farmer and laborers movement. The major stakes of this larger debate concerned, very simply stated, the question, populism, good or bad? Good meaning the embodiment of democracy and mass politics and grassroots democracy, and bad being, was this the origins of authoritarianism and xenophobia and anti-Semitism in the United States? We're kind of going through a similar debate, of course, right now. And so that's how this question of anti-Semitism arose within the broader American historical profession. In answering that question, some pretty famous and important mid-century historians partook in this debate, including Daniel Borstein, Richard Hofstadter. But the most important voices as it concerned anti-Semitism were those of Oscar Hanlon and John Higham. And today they're frequently lumped together. In fact, I have lumped them together in large part as sharing a similar opinion, but actually they saw each other as at opposite ends of answering of the spectrum when they answered this question. So I'm gonna spend a big chunk of this talk talking about them because their ideas were just so influential and important, and they continue to shape the field to a degree that I find rather shocking and impressive. Good for them. May all of our ideas outlast us to the same extent that theirs have. So Hanlon was the son of Jewish immigrants. He earned a PhD from Harvard University in 1940, and he was actually the first Jew hired by the history department at Harvard University. For reasons related to time, I'm not gonna go too far into his biography, but it's important to know that while he was at Harvard during his time there, he most definitely encountered anti-Jewish discrimination, and he spent his entire life denying the fact that he encountered these incidents, even though there's documented evidence that he did, which I do think relates to his articulations and ideas about anti-Semitism. In any case, his assessment of anti-Semitism in the United States appeared in various publications between the late 1940s and throughout the 1950s. Because of time, I'm gonna summarize these views for you, but you again can look for the specific works in my larger article. Briefly, Hanlon's understanding of anti-Semitism was as follows. First of all, he said that American anti-Semitism was a periodic phenomenon. We could not identify continuities in anti-Jewish animus in the United States. And he thought Americans' emphasis on individualism kept any of these expressions in check. Quote, to emphasize the dark aspects of American history would distort the view of the whole. For in the United States, social and economic circumstances have kept alive a tradition of liberty and equality, a tradition which has generally left little room for anti-Semitic prejudices. In his view, anti-Jewish undercurrents were an exception to the norm. In fact, he exclaimed, and I quote, the first two centuries of the American experience were almost completely free of expressions of hostility to the Jews. In a 1951 article that he wrote, which analyzed Jewish stock characters in popular magazines from the late in the late 19th century, he said that the late 19th century was actually free of anti-Semitism, despite the appearances of these arguably anti-Jewish characters. And he said these were really jokes. These were printed in good fun. These negative portrayals really only became problematic in his view right before World War I and until just after it. So between 1913 and 1920. That was really the only really problematic time in his view. Again, when he discussed very, very well-known episodes of anti-Jewish animus, and these include the 1877 Seligman Affair, which is a famous incident in which a very wealthy Jewish banker was denied admission accommodations at a fancy hotel in upstate New York, and Grant's Orders No. 11, an incident in which Ulysses S. Grant expelled Jews as a class from areas of the South during the Civil War. He said these incidents were bad, but they were exceptional. And I quote, exceptional. As it concerned populism, Hanlon explained that indeed anti-Jewish animus could be traced to populists who saw Jews as the embodiments of urbanism and capitalism. So he was on the side of populists are trouble for Jews. However, he also thought that Jews weren't their main concern. These ideas appeared most famously in his book, Adventure and Freedom, which is a history of Jews in the United States. So that's Hanlon. At the same time that Hanlon's writing, we see John Higham also publish his thoughts on anti-Semitism, and specifically as they concerned populism. Higham completed his PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1949, and his most important works about anti-Semitism appeared in two 1957 articles, which, again, may every academic have this luxury. He then reprinted in various forms for decades, and he really didn't come up with many new ideas after that, just two articles that he got to reuse for like 40 years, and really became probably the most significant thinker as it concerns anti-Semitism in the United States based on these two articles. It's shocking to me, actually. So in these two articles, Higham took a slightly different view of anti-Semitism. Unlike Hanlon, who thought World War I was really the most important time period, he thought the Gilded Age was, quote, the formative era of anti-Jewish bigotry in the United States. And it's because that was the period that he saw the emergence of, and I quote, social anti-Semitism, a pattern of discrimination, and the crystallization of political anti-Semitism. In his view, anti-Semitism must be understood as it manifested itself in Jews' lived experiences. So it was not ideological, it was not political, it was about personal interactions. He also articulated some, quote, guiding principles that must be used to understand anti-Semitism in order to enable the writing of what he called an objective history, which was itself engaging in another debate, which continues to this day, about whether or not any history can be objective. So his first rule was that before the late 19th century, it must be understood that non-Jews had as many positive associations with Jews as negative ones. And the fact that that Jews were associated with both positive ideas and negative ideas was so important to him because it should, quote, discourage historians from exaggerating or underrating the phenomenon. Second, historians need to, quote, study the role that the minority group itself plays in the conflict situation. Jews' behaviors needed to be scrutinized as much as anti-Semites' misperceptions, because their behaviors might trigger anti-Semitic animus. Quote, a deeper historical understanding must take into account the factors within Jewish history that have served to magnetize external antagonisms. And continuing, he identified things such as their determination to mingle with elite society, their, quote, assertive manners and aggressive personalities, and their displays of Jewish wealth as reasons that prompted, that triggered anti-Semitic animus. And again, to this modern reader, it was really shocking to see someone blame Jews, quote, assertive manners and aggressive personalities to basically use stereotypes to blame Jews for the expressions of anti-Jewish animus. And he in particular pointed to the Seligman affair, this incident in which a Jewish banker was excluded from an upstate New York hotel, as an example of Jews really triggering anti-Semitic backlash. If only they hadn't desired to stay in these types of places, they wouldn't have triggered such expressions. His third rule was about taking a, quote, consistently comparative approach, examining anti-Semitism in the context of other group hatreds. initially, this sounds like a great idea, I'll say, but he thought the real importance of this was that because it should temper historians' identification of anti-Semitism, that when we look to other group hatreds, we'll see that really anti-Semitism is not really a problem. He further developed these ideas later in 1957 in another article claiming that before the Civil War, quote, Jews enjoyed almost complete social acceptance and freedom. And he specifically attacked, quote, ideological anti-Semitism. And he thought that people like such as Handlin and others exaggerated, quote, the power of irrational beliefs. Again, his emphasis was on this idea of social. This was really about conflict between, real life conflict between social groups. That is what was triggering any anti-Jewish sentiment that existed in the United States. It was not about economic discrimination. It was not about legal discrimination. And as evidence for this, he pointed to Jews' capacities to operate their own hotels to say really like things like the Seligman affair, they're not that bad. It's not a big deal to be excluded from certain hotels. Jews are rich enough to start their own hotels, which he wrote about. So that's Haim and Handlin. Again, this is a very simplistic version of their ideas. To emphasize the differences between them, I just wanna reiterate, they disagreed on populist relationship to anti-Semitism. Whereas Handlin thought anti-Semitism was central to populism, Haim did not. He was a fan of the populists. They also disagreed about the exact timing of anti-Semitic outbursts in the United States. Haim claimed that anti-Jewish sentiments were really related to what he called a cyclical rhythm. And this idea of a cyclical rhythm is something that we see reappear today in many works of American Jewish history. And Handlin really disputed this temporal schema. He called it a simplistic view. They also disagreed about the best method for studying anti-Semitism. Handlin thought it was really important to look at non-Jews' ideas, thoughts, cultural manifestations, whereas Haim was really focused on the ground circumstances. Still, they both pointed to the Gilded Age as an important decade. Handlin really thought that the true expressions of anti-Semitism started later, but they still saw the Gilded Age as important. They also thought that anti-Jewish bigotry was really related to anti-immigrant bigotry generally. And they also both believed that the unique economic success of the United States had tempered anti-Jewish sentiments, but they also thought that Jews' particular economic success made them targets. They both agreed that anti-Semitism in America paled in comparison with anti-Semitism in Europe, an idea that we'll see reappear over and over again. And they both, most importantly, determined that anti-Semitism in American history was relatively insignificant and temporary. Handlin, who made this claim most forcefully, argued that anti-Jewish animus was basically harmless until the second decade of the 20th century. Haim thought anti-Semitism predated that time, but he limited his analysis of anti-Jewish sentiment to the social realm. So, and also, as I noted earlier, Handlin not only really minimized the importance of anti-Semitism historically, but also in his own life. Again, these men saw each other as, they saw themselves as disagreeing very strongly with each other. But when we see their ideas within the larger picture, we'll see that they had a lot of similarities and their ideas become kind of lumped together. Okay. There's a lot to be said about these two men, but I'm gonna move on so that I can get to the ways forward. The most important thing to know is that their ideas really shape all subsequent research on anti-Semitism in the United States. In most cases, explicitly, insofar as historians use their work as a springboard for their own, again, when they talk about anti-Semitism, or implicitly. So their work again comes out in the late 1940s, early 1950s. In the 1960s and 1970s, by and large, historical debates about anti-Semitism in the United States die out. There's not much written during this time period. And then in the 1970s, between the 1970s and the 1990s, we see once again a flourishing in the field. Again, I say that with the caveat that there wasn't that much produced, but there was some work. There was some work produced in the 1970s, between the 1970s and onward. And during this time period, Hanlon and Higham's ideas are tested and discussed. Again, for because of time, I'm going to just point to the two most important scholars from this time period and schools of thought. The first and most important was that of a man named Leonard Dinerstein, who probably, in my estimation, is the only historian who's ever dedicated his entire career to studying anti-Semitism in the United States. And I think most historians, if they would guess who I would be talking about primarily in this talk, it would be him, because by as far as volume and longevity, he has produced the most. His first book was actually published in 1962, and it was about the Leo Frank affair, which was a lynching that occurred in 1915 Atlanta. An event which he described this violence as isolated. And he also published a number of edited volumes that included works which are now really central topics for people who study anti-Semitism to explore in the United States. These are topics that include anti-Jewish quotas at universities, anti-Semitism, regional anti-Semitism, and particularly anti-Semitism in the American South, so-called Black anti-Semitism. Again, he was probably the most prolific scholar to write about anti-Semitism in the United States. However, in my estimation, his work does not reach the level of importance of that of Hanlon or Higham, because he never stepped away from or critiqued the initial paradigms or guiding principles of either of those men. And to the contrary, he upheld them, repeating them over and over again, and especially the ideas of John Higham. He really followed their lead in discussing anti-Semitism, even in cases when it really didn't make sense, such as anti-Jewish violence in the South, right? Describing incidents such as the Leo Frank affair as isolated or exceptional, when we look at this larger phenomenon of anti-Jewish violence, it was not, in fact, exceptional in many ways. Now, by contrast with Dinerstein, there was this other group of dissenters who did actually exist during this time period. These include historians such as David Gerber, who traced anti-Semitism in America to the early 19th century, a literary scholar named David Dobokowski, who very explicitly wrote that Hanlon and Higham's work were, quote, misleading oversimplifications, and the scholar Naomi Cohen, whose work also explicitly disputed the supposed dearth of anti-Semitism in the 19th century. Now, despite the fact that Higham and Hanlon had this pretty prolific group, again, relatively speaking, of challengers, these other works really never infiltrated the field of American Jewish history. They never really became part of the dominant narrative. Why not? I think there's an overlap between reasons that were personal and political. On the one hand, you had Higham and Hanlon, who by the 1970s had really risen to the pinnacle of their careers and to the pinnacle of the profession. Hanlon won the Pulitzer Prize. He was now at this point tenured at Harvard and had been recognized as someone who helped found immigration history. Higham also was recognized as someone who really created American immigration history. And he, by the early 1970s, had been elected as president of the Organization of American Historians, which is the most important professional organization for American historians. So they're really at the top of their field. And the 1970s is also the decade when the field of American Jewish history itself comes into existence as its own subfield within American history. And I argue and I think that these dynamics really prevented these dissenters from being accepted by the broader field of American Jewish history and American history generally, Again, if you're a young person or someone who's newly entering the field and you're going to adopt someone's argument or going to adopt the argument of people who are challenging, really people who represent the most important people within this broader field, or are you going to probably lean in towards these louder voices, these more prominent voices, who are recognized as these giants? So that's the 1970s through the 1990s. And since the 1990s, there has been a similar pattern, a similar dynamic has been created. Because when we look at recent works, and particularly monographs and surveys, and their discussions of anti-Semitism, we really see, once again, a reiteration of Handlin and Haim's claims. And I think there are no two better historians to look at and the work to look at than Jonathan Sarna and Hassia Diner, who are two of the most prominent historians in the field of American Jewish history. Jonathan Sarna, in American Judaism, A Survey of American Jewish History, essentially rearticulates in very similar language Haim's analysis, though he does dispute Handlin's. He has been very clear, not only in his published work, but in conversations with me, that he does agree that both with my assessment and with that he furthers Haim's analysis, but also he has explicitly said to me, yes, John Haim, in my estimation, is the most important theorist of anti-Semitism in the United States. And I have adopted wholeheartedly from his published work from 1981 onwards, his assessment. Hassia Diner, by contrast, she also adopts Haim's view of anti-Semitism, but she also supports Handlin. Sarna says, I don't think Handlin's correct, and he's gone too far. He downplays anti-Semitism too much. Hassia Diner, however, in her written work, both in her survey, The Jews of the United States, her various monographs, and in discussions specifically of Oscar Handlin, has said, people can claim this is they've downplayed anti-Semitism. I don't think so. I think they're right. So at the same time, we've also seen yet again a small group of people who have challenged the ideas presented, but their work has largely been ignored and hasn't infiltrated the larger field, the larger meta-narrative of American Jewish history. And so we yet again see this absence of anti-Semitism in the United States. That was a very long summary, and I've left very little time for myself to offer some ways forward. So I'm just gonna jump right to that section. So I'm gonna give my most important ones. So I can't give a comprehensive list. So some of my suggestions for how I hope American Jewish historians, Jewish historians generally, historians generally will understand anti-Semitism in the United States going forward. The first two suggestions really require acknowledging the work of two historians that I think are really important ideas. The first is that of Tony Michaels, who wrote an article in 2010 about the concept of American Jewish exceptionalism, which is this idea that American Jewish historians advance, that Jewish history in America is different than Jewish history elsewhere. This has been a paradigm deployed over and over again. And part of this paradigm posits that one reason that American Jewish history is exceptional is because of the supposed lack of anti-Semitism in the United States. And in this article, he calls for actual comparisons to be made as opposed to presumptions to be presented. He calls for understanding European Jewish history as not, Europe is not one monolithic place, that if we look at individual countries, we can see similarities between American Jewish history and Jewish history elsewhere. And to avoid deploying this exceptionalist paradigm, in doing so will enable us to see patterns of anti-Jewish animus. So I think embracing his work would be one really important step to take. Second, embracing the work of David Sorkin, who has, rather definitively illustrated most recently in his book, Jewish Emancipation, that Jews in the United States did indeed undergo an emancipation process, which is something that has long been disputed or denied by, I think, the main, by Jewish historians. In other words, Jews in the United States have in fact engaged in a process in which they needed to negotiate their political and civil liberties. And in recognizing this argument, we can see instances in which law has in fact been used and deployed to minimize Jewish rights in the United States. So again, embracing those two arguments are probably two of the most important ways to move forward. The third, and one that I find to be hugely important, concerns the very sticky subject of Jews and whiteness. And this is hugely important to my mind. Of course, scholars have been looking at the ideas of Jews and whiteness for roughly the past 30, maybe even 40 years actually. And in that time, scholars have drawn a variety of conclusions about Jews' racial identity in the United States. But by and large, most of these works have generated a narrative in which Jews, in the words of Karen Brodkin, became white at some point. And we really see a linear trajectory about Jews and whiteness. And I think this is hugely problematic and really deters scholars from understanding anti-Semitism in the United States for a few reasons. Scholars frequently presume that Jews have had the option of just electing whiteness and have granted Jews far too much agency in that process instead of recognizing whiteness as something, as a political identity and category that's bestowed upon populations who have power, that this wasn't necessarily a choice, even when Jews were actually trying to claim it, that Jews have had far less agency in adopting this identity. And the labeling of Jews of white frequently has neglected to understand that white is, of course, an unstable political category. That is itself a construct. It's presumed and applied backwards and anachronistically. What do I mean by this? The number of times I've seen Jews identified as white in scholarly works as an assertion as opposed to something that needs to be illustrated is rather shocking. And I often see it in cases in which the primary sources that are provided dispute the categorization itself. So the trial transcript itself will say, you know, the person is described as dark and not white, but the historian will describe the person as white as if it is a self-evident assertion. Doing that really prevents us from understanding the nuances of race in the United States and racial categorization and anti-Jewish animus and the way that race and non-whiteness and anti-Jewish animus have overlapped here. So again, at the risk of being repetitive, presuming Jews' whiteness has really led to the obfuscation and ignoring of blatantly anti-Semitic incidents. And I'd be happy to offer some examples of that during the Q&A. The other suggestions I have is recognition of patterns, avoiding identifying instances as exceptions, avoid minimizing instances of personal expressions of anti-Jewish animus, avoid presuming a lack of structural discrimination, and then of course, recognizing the tremendous overlap between anti-Semitism and other isms, in particular anti-Black racism. I think all of these suggestions really will enrich and advance the field in ways that Chaim and Hanlon both did not anticipate and help us to overcome the serious walls that they built mid 20th century. So I think I've gone over my time and I appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Britt. There's an awful lot there to think about and to talk about. We've got about 25 minutes for questions and for a discussion. If you do have a question or a comment that you'd like to make, please raise your hand in the participants section, and I'll invite you to unmute yourself. Stephen Pagani has had his hand up for some time. So, Stephen, would you like to start us off?
Okay. Hello. I know very little about the United States, or at least in terms of the Jewish dimension, but I'm intrigued and surprised by the notion of Jewish exceptionalism, because I would have thought that many of the factors that feed into antisemitism in a European context, and I'm thinking particularly of religious Christian doctrines and sentiments, would also be present in the United States. And then perhaps supplementary to that, my assumption would have been that European communities migrating to the United States, whether from Poland, the Ukraine, wherever, would bring some of their prejudices and presuppositions with them. So why, if it is the case, why has the United States been able to overcome some of this legacy of the past? Thank you.
So that's a great question. So to be clear, I personally do not support this idea of American Jewish exceptionalism, but the idea itself, which we see is a very prominent idea present in the field and in the historiography, emerges also in the mid 20th century. And the idea of American Jewish exceptionalism, which is of course related to American exceptionalism generally, was premised on two big ideas. One was that anti-Semitism in the United States is really not that big of a deal, especially compared with anti-Semitism in Europe. Of course, this idea is introduced right in the immediate aftermath of the Holocaust. And so, scholars are looking around saying, well, there was no genocide of Jews here, right? That place, that's really bad. This place is really good. We're different. The second major idea that's a part of this American Jewish exceptionalist perspective is the claim that Jews in the United States did not undergo emancipation, unlike Jews across Europe. So again, emancipation, if we understand it as a process through which Jews gained political and civil rights and liberties, people who promote or adopt this idea of American Jewish exceptionalism claim, again, I estimate and following, being very convinced by the work of David Sorkin, I estimate that this is wrong. But they claim, well, Jews in the United States did not undergo an emancipation process. And as evidence for this, they point, of course, to the US Constitution, and they point to the First Amendment, and they say, look right here, freedom of religion. Jews did not. Where in the US Constitution do you see anything that says Jews can't? Jews aren't even mentioned, right? Jews come to America and have full rights and freedoms. This is not true. This is factually not true. This is a misunderstanding of the relationship between the federal government and state governments in the 18th and 19th century. There are many reasons to be suspicious of this idea, but it's when we go and look at American Jewish surveys, we see this pointing to the text of the American Constitution as if it has only ever meant one thing for all of time without and has never been subject to interpretation, and we can just read it as face value. So those are the ideas that American Jewish exceptionalism are premised on. I would agree that there are reasons to be suspicious of this, including the importance of Christian doctrine in the United States, including the fact that people who came here did not view Jews as necessarily their equals. Those are the two major ideas related to American Jewish exceptionalism. And in Tony Michels' estimation, at least according to my interpretation of his work, he has said that one reason why anti-Semitism in the United States has been ignored has been because of the dominance of this paradigm in the writing of American Jewish history.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you, Britt. Louise London, you have a question or a comment.
Yes. Thank you. That's very interesting. Can you hear me now? Great. Yeah. So what I wanted to ask you about is whether the question of how people can tell who is a Jew and who is not a Jew plays out in the debate that you're discussing. Coming from the British context in the 20th century, and with a particular interest in the question of restrictions on Jewish on aliens changing their names. I wonder whether the question of names identifying Jews or any other things like dress or where you come from or other things are present in the material that you looked at or you think people might think about.
I love this question. Thank you for asking it. So a few things. What has identified, we're really asking is, what has identified Jews as Jews to non-Jews over time?
Yeah.
Great question. And it's something I think about a lot. I actually keep a notebook and a running list of how Jewish difference has been identified in American history. That's I keep chronologically because it's a fascinating thing to think about. So there are a few answers to that question, but I'm going to go specifically right away so I don't miss it to the question of names. First of all, there's a fantastic book by a woman named Kirsten Vermeiglisch, a Rosenberg by any other name.
Yes.
And she tells us in this book that in fact, Jewish name changing that took place in the mid 20th century was in part a reflection of the existence of anti-Jewish animus and an effort to really circumvent anti-Jewish animus. This is why like the Greenbergs become Greens. And there's a deep irony, of course, there is because when Jews change their names, they change their names to similar names where the new names then become identified as Jewish. So I think that's I love her argument and I think it's very astute. In my own research, I have seen accusation repeatedly over and over and over, accusations of name changing as being a specifically Jewish trait and something that people should know about. So I'm currently researching accusations of Jewish arson in the United States. And Jewish name-changing practices is something that's discussed frequently by non-Jewish underwriters and non-Jewish insurance agents as something to look out for. That when people apply for fire insurance, you need to make sure that you can't tell just by looking at their names. You need to like make sure that they're not Jewish because Jews will change their names. Again, I've also seen in the context of my research on Jewish lawyers, efforts in the early 20th century to change one's name, again, likely to be able to be appealing to non-Jewish clients, and judges denying these lawyers the right to change their name, saying, no, no, no. And actually telling them explicitly, you're not suffering because of your name. I'm not going to let you change your name. So the idea that Jews are shapeshifters, right, that's what this accusation really involves, right? It's not just the literal name that people have a problem with. It's the idea that Jews are somehow trying to hide themselves, hide their true nature, hide whatever nefarious activity that they're engaged in. I think it's something that Jews are frequently accused of for at least from the mid 19th century through really the 1970s. And that is one characteristic of Jewish difference, certainly.
Thank you, Britt. Susan Wolf, you have a question.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
My father was I'm Jewish American living in London. And my father spent 20 years as an American Jewish army doctor, which was fairly unusual. So growing up in the military, and one of the last places that he was posted before his retirement was in the American South in Georgia, where my grandmother didn't want to come visit because of what, this was in the 50s, did not want to come to where, because of what had happened to Leo Frank. So that whole story was very much a part of my life and upbringing. We then moved to the American Midwest, where he's for some stupid reason settled in a horrible little conservative town. But we were the only Jewish people, and that was the first time that I experienced any anti-Semitism personally in my life as a kid, with kids telling me that they didn't want to walk to school with me because I was Jewish and that sort of thing. And the school giving me an F for the day if I took off for the high holy days, because as they said, if we let you take the day off, then we have to let anyone who belongs to any old cult skip school. I went then to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which is, yeah, I see this one. Were you at Madison?
Yeah, that's right.
It was great, wasn't it? And there were, back then, everybody, if you were under 21, girls, and we were called girls, had to live in dorms. Girls, this is back in the mid 60s, girls had hours. You had to be in the dorm at 11 o'clock at night. Boys didn't have hours and all this stuff. But there were Jewish dorms. There were private dorms that were Jewish. And, you know, they weren't Orthodox. They didn't keep kosher. There wasn't any of that. But what I found is that a lot of kids from, you know, the Midwest would say to me, I've never met a Jewish person before. You're the first. And then they would tell me, because Elizabeth Taylor had just converted to Judaism in her marriage to Mike Todd, they would tell me I looked like Elizabeth Taylor. I don't look remotely like Elizabeth Taylor, but they would pick a Jewish person. And then of course, when Barbara Streisand became famous, everybody told me I look like Barbara Streisand and I don't look like anything like her either. But it was always sort of interesting to me that they had to, it was like saying, I'm okay with your being Jewish. You look like, you know, Barbara Streisand. And I experienced more of that sort of thing in the American North, in the American Midwest, than I ever did as a child in the South, which I think is sort of interesting. Anyway, I just wanted to say, and thank you for the work you're doing.
I know there wasn't a question there, but I just want to say that there's a really great article by Jonathan Pollack about anti-Jewish discriminatory housing practices at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Oh, really?
Name of which I can, but if you just look up Jonathan Pollack, University of Wisconsin Jews on Google, I think that the article will likely show up. Otherwise, you can find my email easily. I'd be happy to send it to you. I do think that also what you pointed to about the perception of Jewish physicality and Jewish physical difference is another mainstay of this perception of Jews as different and distinct. And once again, speaks to and I think negates this like overwhelming notion of Jewish whiteness that we can see deployed, I think, very lazily by a lot of scholars over and over again. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan and Britt. There are two more hands up, and I'm anxious to get sort of both comments or questions in and answers to them. So if we take them together and then Britt responds to both. So first of all, we have a question or a comment from Tony Kamens. Tony?
Yes. Hi, I'm an American Jew from New York who lives in Paris. I'm particularly interested in the Jewish emancipation angle, because I think if you look at different places of Jewish settlement in the United States, you might find something. Obviously, it's not the same thing as the official emancipation out of the ghettos that Jews underwent in many European countries. But I think New York probably had something of a Jewish emancipation. especially, you know, from the beginning of settlement and, you know, through the early 20th century, maybe. And also, I mean, even these days, I've encountered more anti-Semitism in New York than practically anywhere. I mean, I remember, you know, ages ago, my husband and I were looking for an apartment, and I found a couple of places that we wanted. My name doesn't sound Jewish. The second my husband shows up with his very Jewish looking face and obviously Jewish name, all of a sudden the apartments are gone.
Thank you, Tony. Stephen, do you want to make your comment or ask your question?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you very much for the really clear talk and also, I thought, particularly interesting comments on Jewishness and whiteness. But I just wanted to ask, it's a kind of disciplinary question that, not being a historian myself, but coming at this from psychosocial studies, psychoanalysis, if I was to think about mid-century, if I do think about mid-century writings on anti-Semitism from America, I'd go straight to the Studies in Prejudice series funded by the American Jewish, whatever they were called, Association or whatever. I'm just curious, really, because it's not mentioned in your very interesting account of the historiography of anti-Semitism in America. I mean, is there any crossover between these different approaches to understanding anti-Semitism? And if so, where does it manifest? And if not, what blocks that?
Both, I'm going to answer the questions backwards. Thank you so much. The question about the Studies in Prejudice series, I believe it's, I'm not mistaken, that Oscar Hanlon, so both Oscar Hanlon and John Higham, their work in the mid-century, their initial work was sponsored by the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Historical Society, which are two organizations that continue to exist today, which absolutely had a very particular ideological perspective on what constituted anti-Semitism. And what's so interesting to me, and this article and all of this research was done during COVID, so I didn't have the opportunity to go to the archives to look into this further, the organizational archives, but they both adopted this idea of anti-Semitism happening, not in a structural sense, not in a legal sense, not in a political sense, but in this social sense from these organizations. And these organizations, really adopted their understanding of what anti-Semitism is from earlier understandings of anti-Semitism in late 19th century Europe, which is of course where the origin of the word anti-Semitism emerges, these emancipation debates in Germany. And so in other words, there is overlap, there is ideological influence of these Jewish organizations in the initial thinking of both of these men. And of course, these organizations have their own political stances and reasons for wanting to promote a very specific interpretation of anti-Semitism as opposed to another, including their own political posturing and positioning. I haven't been able to show, other than the fact that actually John Higham was paid by the American, I believe, Jewish Congress to write these initial analyses, which I don't think is something to ignore, although I have been told that anything that I'm implying, anything that was nefarious that I'm implying, I was shamed without having additional evidence. But I do think there's something meaningful to being paid by an organization and adopting their particular perspective. So I think that you're pointing to is hugely important in an area for further research. To speak to Tony's question, about emancipation. So David Sorkin, in his recently published book, Jewish Emancipation, argues, and I think really shows indisputably, that Jews in America did undergo emancipation, a particular paradigm of emancipation that is more akin to the emancipation process in Britain and in France. And that the example you pointed to is actually an example I would have pointed to, and it's exactly right, which is that the state was absolutely involved in denying Jews civil rights insofar as they permitted housing discrimination, both at state universities like the University of Wisconsin-Madison and many other state, big state universities, insofar as they permitted housing discrimination even in places such as New York. And there are other examples including the Army. The U.S. Army was a huge, huge. There's a lot of work done on this as well. A huge source and site for anti-Jewish discrimination. So the state was involved, and needing to negotiate civil and political liberties has been an important aspect, and continues to be an important aspect of American Jewish history that I think needs to be recognized. And recognizing the legal components of anti-Jewish animus, I think will really open a whole new avenue for research.
Thank you, Britt. Thank you very much. We're almost out of time, but I'd like just to take the small amount of time that's left to thank everyone who's come along this afternoon, especially those who asked such a serious and probing questions and raised points. And I think it's been a serious discussion, which is no less than Britt's clearly delivered, careful and intellectually challenging talk has deserved. So Britt, thank you very much. We're hugely in your debt. I found this completely fascinating, and from a personal point of view, I look forward to discussing these issues with you more in the future. And I'm sure we all look forward to reading you more in the future. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
On Wisconsin.